Okay, rule 10. Let's see how far we can go down with this. Yeah, I've had to cut it off at a certain point because we can't go into the entirety of it by any means. As the waters bathe the form created, they are absorbed and used. The form increases in its strength. Let the magician thus continue until the work suffices. Let the outer builders cease their labors then, and let the inner workers enter on their cycle. Okay. One of the fundamental concepts which is grasped by all magical workers is that both will and desire are force emanations. We can think of will particularly emanating from the atmic plane. Will from the atmic, and desire from the astral. This is the plane of spiritual will. From another point of view, the monad or spirit has its highest aspect or will aspect. But desire cannot be confined to the emotional level because the entire cosmic astral plane is involved also in cosmic desire. This is kind of an opposition between Vulcan and Mars. And we all know that there must be a way. It is constantly the case that Vulcan subdues Mars. Will subdues desire. Now, when you look at esoteric astrology, page 71, you see an interesting thing about the... Whoops, that won't work. Sorry. Do you want to save the changes? That's always a question. Probably not. We get to this section of the third initiation. And we see that at the third initiation, the moon veiling a hidden planet and Mars bring about a fearful conflict. But at the end, the man is released from personality control. And I think that that hidden planet is Vulcan. You know, we could say it's Uranus, but Uranus is not a hidden planet. Uranus has a lot to do with the third initiation, because that's the first time you meet the Hierophant, the Lord of the World, or Sanat Kumara, the one initiator. And he is Uranian in nature because for the first time you are exposed in your consciousness and your energy system to a straight dose of electric fire coming via Uranus. So Uranus makes sense there at the third degree because you change from Neptune to Uranus. The Christ, Lord Maitreya, is Neptune. The one initiator, from that perspective, is Uranus. But neither Neptune nor Uranus were hidden at the time of this writing. And Vulcan was hidden, and still is hidden. And when we're dealing with initiation, Vulcan is definitely involved. You can find Vulcan at every initiation, all the way from the first to the fifth. So my guess is that we're dealing here with the moon veiling Vulcan as the expressor of a spiritual will and Mars being the expression of personality desire. Yes.
Why has he said veiling a hidden planet? Because in the others he's put Mercury and Saturn, Uranus and Jupiter. Why is he being so
To get us to think, I think. To get us to think, I think, yes, yes. And because he wants us to understand what is the role of Vulcan, of a blinding light at the third initiation. Vulcan, if you think about St. Paul's third initiation and his experience with a greater will than his own and a light which blinded him, it's a Vulcan experience. However, he wants us to think about this. You could say, well, maybe it's such a hidden planet that we've never even heard of it, and maybe it's not Vulcan either. So it could be. But there's so much about Vulcan which is in the nature of the third degree and is hidden that I think it is the correct planet. Have you had Vulcan versus Mars experiences in your own life? And if so, how do they work out? I mean, you know, usually desire wants to run away with you. And when you say to a person, hey, get a grip on yourself, that's Vulcan. It is the restraining spiritual will which controls and suppresses. It holds things down. It suppresses desire. It pushes it right down and said, we're thinking here, we're willing here, we're not emotional about this. And I think that has to be shown at the third degree. I think that at the third degree, the will of the soul must dominate Mars, which represents the desire of the entire personality. Mars is the personality, Vulcan is the soul, and we end now what's called the ancient authority of the personality at this point. Vulcan versus Mars. So, will and desire are force emanations. They differ in quality and vibration, but are essentially currents of energy. And there's always, there's always duality in desire and unity in will. Do you think that Vulcan fits at all with the atomic plane?
There is a link because it's at the crown, and that goes along with, you know, the third degree, the mind,
The entire personality. And the will, the coming in of the will at the third degree. And remember what he said, that the head center rules the atomic plane. Head center is the representative of the atomic plane, and Vulcan, in the disciple, rules the head center. So I think there's many planets we can find on different planes, but I think Vulcan has a strong effect. I also think that Vulcan is particularly connected with the Agni Chaitans. You know, the fiery furnaces and the volcanic action and all of that. I think there are higher and lower Agni Chaitans. I think that on the atomic plane you have the higher Agni Chaitans and on the physical etheric, the lower. Just like on the Buddhic plane, the higher Agni Suryans, and on the astral plane, the lower Agni Suryans. So, will and desire, it's a tough one to solve, but let's just say that with will there is always centralization, and with desire there is always duality and a magnetism between dualities. So there's many ways we could contrast this, and I think we get the main idea. Will and desire are essentially currents of energy, and I would distinguish them as reaching for and opposing, I see, imposing upon. That's how I discriminate these two. One forming an initial vortex or center of activity, being centrifugal, the other being centripetal, and the main factor in the accretion of matter into a form around a central vortex. So I think desire reaches out, and the sixth ray type, full of Mars and full of desire, of that type, it is said, run not so straight. The word goes forth from soul to form. Run not so straight. The path that you are on leads to the outer circle of the life of God. The line goes forward to the outer rim, Mars, six ray. Instead, stand at the center, look on every side, die not for outer forms, forget not God who dwells behind the vision, love more your fellow men. So, I believe that Mars desire is centrifugal. And Vulcan, Venus, is centripetal. And I think, is the first ray magnetic in any sense? This is a trick question.
If synthesis includes magnetism, which it does.
Yeah, it does do that. Let's take a look at this. Here it says the first rate person is strong but not so easily magnetic. And here it says, in a more advanced book, that attraction and magnetism, students are apt to think that magnetism is a second ray activity. They are right insofar as all systemic laws are expressions of the life of God through the medium at this time of the second ray, which makes our solar system a second ray system. All other laws and qualities, for a law from the divine angle is the motivating qualified agent of the divine will as understood in Shambhala, are related to the second ray as it manifests through our planetary logos. Nevertheless, and this is the important one, magnetic action is more closely allied to first ray functioning than it is to second ray, and is an aspect or quality of the law of synthesis, holding all things together. It was this magnetic power of the first ray to which the Christ referred when he said, I, if I be lifted up, the ascension initiation, will draw all men unto me. He faced then those initiations which would qualify him to become what is esoterically called a Shambhala recipient. There is in magnetic action much more of the element of the will and of an expressing purpose. In explanation, it might be said that the radiation of the hierarchy, which is definitely second ray in nature, and which is projected as attractive radiation, is implemented by the magnetic aspect. So So this is an important idea, and it justifies the idea of considering Vulcan as indicating centralization and a form of magnetism which draws all things to the center. And Vulcan, on top of it, has not only first-ray qualities, but qualities of the magnetic second and fourth ray in a deeply interior sense. So Vulcan is involved in the accretion of matter around a central vortex. And we think of Vulcan as that force which creates density. Is it a new healing device?
New toilet. New toilet.
Ah, that's the sound of the Roto-Rooter. All right. This can be seen demonstrating in an interesting way in the case of the egoic lotus, where we have the will aspect forming the jewel in the lotus, or the inner center of electrical energy, and the desire or love aspect forming the egoic lotus itself, or the form which hides the center. So we have a magnetic, and we all know, or maybe should know, that Vulcan rules the jewel in the lotus. All highly compressed and radiant items are ruled by Vulcan, who has a very strong artistic aspect to it as well. Only it's artistry in hard things. That's how Vulcan works. Metal, stone. If you see an artist hacking away, using these instruments and whatever, to shape really hard things into a beautiful form, Vulcan is at work. Okay, so we've established that there is a magnetism drawing to the center, connected with the first ray, and that the law of attraction of the second ray is implemented by the magnetism of the first ray, or will. And so basically, you could basically say will holds the center, and desire rushes forth to the periphery.
And that is Venus between Vulcan and Mars.
And Venus is also considered centripetal. Venus is magnetically attractive towards the center. But Vulcan is almost like a very strong, irresistible kind of pulling into the center. You cannot get away from it.
Yes. The Venus and Vulcan is married.
And they are married. And they are married. Yeah, and they are married. So basically, we sometimes have a Sun-Venus conjunction oppose Mars, or square Mars. That would be an example of centripetal versus centrifugal forces in the life. How does that work for you? Do you find yourself to be an outgoing centrifugal individual, or an ingoing centralizing centripetal individual? Or, like the hierarchy, are you both? The hierarchy has to move out towards humanity and in towards Shambhala, the jewel.
We have to do the same now, on a lesson term of the spiral, don't
we? We're asked to do something similar.
Oh.
We're asked to move in and out at the same time. Okay. The analogy in all form building holds good for gods, men, and atoms. The solar system. Well, it's kind of an E flat. It's a little, not exactly.
The sacred note of the toilet.
It's the note that makes Greensleeves what it is, and all sad songs. Okay. The solar system from the higher cosmic planes is seen as a vast blue lotus. Higher cosmic planes. Where is that? You know, higher cosmic planes? How high? Cosmic mental plane? And so on down the scale. They're all lotuses. All lotuses. Even the tiny atom of substance can be so considered. The distinction between these various lotuses exists in the number and arrangement of the petals. So I think he's also telling us there are many solar systems. They look like lotuses. They have different petal numbers depending on what function they play. Our sun or solar system is what kind of chakra? It is. It's a heart center. I've got a alright, that's the way it goes. Our solar system is a heart chakra, hence it's a 12-petaled blue lotus. Heart center. The solar system is literally a 12-petaled lotus, each petal being formed of 49 lesser petals. So there are seven major energies of each planet, of the seven major planetary logoi. And seven minor, which equals 49. Is that correct? Here's how I count. Here's a the sun has 12 petals. Each one of these planetary schemes is a petal. And each one of the planetary schemes is 49-fold, correct? Look at that. Are there 49? That's just one planetary scheme. Are there 49 parts? Correct? Right. Seven chains and 49 globes. So it's a 12-petal lotus with each of the petals being formed of 49 lesser petals, so we've got 588, is that correct? 12 times 49? 588 lesser petals in the 12 major petals of the solar system. The planetary lotuses differ in each scheme. And one of the secrets of initiation is revealed when the number of petals of our Earth planet, our planetary polar opposite, and our equilibrizing planet is committed to the initiate. Well, you know, we know what this one is, don't we? our planetary polar opposite, is what planet? What is our planetary polar opposite, the alter ego of our planet?
Venus.
It's Venus. But now comes the question of our complementary or equilibrizing planet. Well, if you want to talk about complementary, you could easily say Mars. But when you talk about equilibrizing, it seems to take it into the realm of Mercury with its fourth ray. Mercury is a better equilibrizer with its balancing fourth ray. Do you think there would be such a thing as a triangle between Earth, Venus, and Mercury?
Yes.
It sounds like it would be an important triangle. What could it stand for? Let's see. If there were Earth, Venus, and Mercury, what could be the correspondences? What do you think?
Uranus, Neptune.
Well, or you could say like this: Saturn, Neptune, Uranus. That's one way of doing it. What about chakras? Or what about vehicles, principles, vehicles? Earth, physical. Venus, astral. Mercury, mental. Vulcan, soul. That's one way to do it. Vulcan is, of course, Vulcan has a soul connection. Vulcan is, we said, associated with the Hos, heart of the sun. Vulcan and the heart of the sun go together. Inwardly, it's a planet that stays very close to the sun and has internal aspects which are like that of the sun. As a matter of fact, it just hit me. It is often said that our sun has a fourth ray monad. But really, a second ray monad. And I would just say, same for Vulcan. Vulcan, ruler of Taurus, the artificer, the craftsman, the workman, the artist, fourth ray monad, first ray soul. But you can't have a major monadic ray, which is 4, 5, 6, or 7. So my guess is that Vulcan is a very close student of the sun, right in there close, with certain closely identified with the sun and with its interior nature. I think our sun, I think ultimately, this is my guess, our solar logos is 2, 2, 2. Just 2, 2. And Vulcan, ultimately, would be 2, 4, 1, and whatever its personality will be. When I put it in those big letters, it means the monad. So, ultimately, even Vulcan would be 2, 1. And I'll bet, it comes to me, that in the next solar system, Vulcan becomes very important. Why? What will our next solar system be? next solar system is a will system with the rays 2, 4, 2, 1. So our solar logos will have a first ray personality in the next solar system. And it will keep its second ray soul and probably move towards a second ray monad off of its fourth ray monad. But with Vulcan's rays, you can see that it could play a big role in that system. As a matter of fact, well, all right, I've said a lot here, but I don't want to get into it too deeply. So we have a relationship here between our planet Earth with 4 petals, Venus with 10 petals, and Mercury with how many? Earth, 4 petals, like a base of spine center. Venus, 10 petals, like a solar plexus center. And Mercury is what in our solar system? What chakra could it be connected with in our solar system? Thus, 2 and 96. 48 here, 48 here. If man reflects the solar logos. Because in man, the solar plexus has 10, and the base of the spine has 4. And I wonder, you know, when you look at this numerologically, what happens when you add the petals in 2 centers together? Add the base of the spine and the sacral center, how many do you get? 10. Add the base of the spine and the solar plexus, how many do you get? 14. And I'm wondering if there's not a way to understand this problem of the number 14 by looking at the chakras that add up to 14 and their functions. Okay, it's speculation, but I think it's interesting. Okay, so one day we will know this. One day we will know. Armed with this knowledge, he can then work out certain formulas of magic which enable him to create in the 3 spheres. Does this mean anything to us? I said here some speculations. He knows the rays, he knows which planets he's invoking. He knows how the planet connect with his own chakras and the times when the planets and the petals are vitalized and accessible. When is an energy stream available for me to work with? So magicians care very much about timing, but it's a very fascinating sentence. He can become a magician on 3 planets when he knows the number of petals involved. 3 planets. Is that what it's saying? Yeah. Yeah, there's so much deep magic connected with this. It'll even affect knowing these numbers. Will even affect the types of magical mantras one is using, even rhythm. all based on number. We just have to know what each petal does and how to invoke forces from each petal. Very technical information, one day to be available. What does each petal contain? It is the same basic concepts which governs thought form building and which enables a magician of white magic to produce objective phenomena on the physical plane. He works with two types of energy, will and desire, and their equilibrizing is what leads to the balancing of the pairs of opposites and the subsequent release of energy substance in the formation of physical plane structure. So, I guess he works with this. Will is spirit. Desire is personality. And soul is the equilibrizing force. And I think he's saying that if you want to be a white magician, the third degree will give you all three aspects of divinity to work with. Okay. This is not easy, this section. Probably. Where am I?
Last sentence in orange.
You're correct. There's so much here. So much. Okay. So, then please will you read the next section?
The magician has to know the following facts. One, the formulas for the two aspects of Lagoan energy, will and desire. This is literally apprehension of the note and formula of the Brahma or substance aspect, and the note and formula of the Vishnu or building aspect. One he ascertains because he has mastered matter. The other is revealed to him when he has achieved group consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, does this looks rather interesting. Why does he place will with Vishnu and not with Shiva? He does. Well, okay. Basically, let's look at this. Will has to come through Vishnu, just as the monad has to be expressed through the soul at this time in this second ray solar system. Okay, so here, when you look at the jewel in the lotus, is it a first ray center or a second ray center? Or is it, what do you think? A first ray center or a second ray center? Or is it a first ray center within a second ray center? Yes. Good thought. Yes. Okay, so the jewel in the lotus is a first ray center within a second ray center. It is Shiva within Vishnu. So, there is no pure will in this solar system, only as it is mediated through the second ray. Now, that means that for us, the will of the soul, will of the soul is will. That's how we get will. Until the fourth initiation. And even then, will descends through the triad. So, pure will comes in relatively at the sixth initiation. Why? What happens at the sixth initiation to the spiritual triad? Where is a person centered, an individual centered, at the sixth initiation? In what? In the?
I?
In the monad. So, in a way, and then you might never need your spiritual triad permanent atoms again, as you might be on your way out. So at that time, now you hear of 6-degree initiates, we're called victors through the clear, pure will. Something like that. Let's see. Victor, will, pure, clear, victors. Of the 7 initiations, only 5 concern average humanity. The remaining 2 initiations concern only those who are willing to meet certain unusual requirements and to produce that special effort which entitles them to the appellation victors through the clear, pure will. It's beyond the triad. Okay. So, therefore, when we get will, we don't get the pure thing until very, very high, and maybe never at all. Therefore, the implication here is that if you sound the note of Vishnu, will come through it. Meaning, if you sound the note of Vishnu, will reach the personality coming through the jewel in the lotus from Atma and the monad. So, if we want spiritual will to work for us, we must first contact the soul. In other words, the soul note will bring will too. That's what I'm trying to say. If you contact your soul, spiritual will come with it. Now later, when we build the Antikarana, and as a master, we have a definite contact with Atma, a higher form of spiritual will comes in, but it's still subject to the second aspect. When we become a free monad, then maybe for the first time we know what pure will is. Father, not my will, but thine be done, Christ in Gethsemane at the sixth initiation. And it was a shock to him, we are told, because he received a shaft, a ray of pure, clear will. which entirely revolutionized his approach to the redemption of humanity. All right. So we were talking about formulas here. The magician has to know the following facts. Formulas. The formulas for the two aspects of will and desire. That's one. What else? Please read.
The formula for the particular type of energy substance which he is seeking to employ. This will have relation to that particular petal in the solar lotus from which the desired force emanates.
Now, when you read this, a particular petal in the solar lotus, what thought comes to you? He's going to invoke the energy of a particular petal in the solar lotus, so what is he really doing? Remember, it's a 12-petaled lotus, each petal having 49 lesser petals. So if this magician is trying to work with a particular kind of energy and substance, and to do it, he has to invoke the energy of a solar petal. What is he doing? Is it, because the answer is easy, actually.
Is he stimulating a center?
To it. He is invoking energy from a center within the solar logos. And actually, not only is it easy, but it's written in green. Well said. Again. Meaning that he invokes the energy of a particular planet via the devas associated with that planet in order to handle a certain kind of substance which is ruled by that planet. So it's just like planetary invocation, that's all. But he refers to it in a different way, so we have to think in a different way. If you say to someone, invoke a planet, no problem, I invoke, okay. But if you say to them, invoke the energy of a certain petal in the solar lotus, they'll say, what? But DK is having us connect the dots here. Have you ever felt that you've invoked the energy of a planet?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
We just had a meditation this morning. We do it all the time. Especially at the full moon, don't we? When we're concentrating on a particular energy and we say, let that energy appear in the group. We visualize the glyph, we concentrate, and there's a stream of energy that appears. The old magic is full of this stuff. They have all these magical squares, and you draw a line from here to here to here to here to here in the magical square, and it's called the sigil, S-I-G-I-L, the sigil for that planet.
That's another word for sign, isn't it?
Yeah. Here, I'll give you an idea. You've seen these things before, but this is the old method of invocation. Intelligence, Jupiter intelligence, intelligence. Let's see what happens. Sorry, this is one of the secrets of initiation. Okay. Here it is. Which one is this? Let's see. I'm not sure which one this is. Oh, this is Saturn. Saturn's sigil. Jupiter's sigil. Mars' sigil. Sun. See, they actually thought that by Using these magical squares and connecting certain numbers in certain order, a form was created which gave you sympathetic relationship to the planet that you wanted, from which you wanted the energy to appear. Here is Venus's sigil. I think there are various of these, but maybe this is the Agrippa method. Venus has having two different names and sigils associated with beneficial daemons. So this is also Venus. Now each one of these can be studied. Mercury's sigil.
You see sigils in old Hebrew books, don't you, all the time?
Yeah, not exactly like this, but you see signs that are meant to connect you to the gods and intelligences. This is a Mercury. Whoa. This sigil, published by Henry Cornelius Agrippa in his three books of occult philosophy, is constructed through numerology and magic squares. Yeah. And there is Hebrew names connected with it. The name Tiriel is spelled out in Hebrew, and then each Hebrew letter is associated with a number, as the Hebrew language inherently does. Each number is located on the magic square of Mercury, and a line is drawn to pass through each number. Here's the magic square of Mercury. Each one is different. This is the whole seventh ray, third ray system, which is the Western occult tradition, and which is the method of contacting the intelligences of Mercury. We could read about this, but I just to give you the idea of the signs and symbols that are used to invoke the presence of a certain intelligence. Fascinating stuff. But as DK says, definitely a tertiary form of revelation. And when he says that, he's not just wasting words, because it is the method of occultism of the previous tertiary solar system under the third ray. It's the third ray method. Now, some teachers like Master DK and Blavatsky and others know all about the old system, and they can link it with the new one. They know Kabbalah, and they know the new system too. So maybe we could do that ourselves. All right. So a particular petal in the solar logos, see, how do you get to a planet? So in the group, we can say, okay, here's the group. Here's the symbol of Jupiter. Here is its color. Here is its note. Sound the note, see the colors, see the symbol, invoke the energy. But the third ray system will say, wait, you need the Hebrew letters, you need the magic square, you need a particular this and that, you need the hour of the day, you need all these details, etc. And maybe there is something to that. Only experimentation will truly reveal. Okay. We'll go on to the next one.
The formula for the particular type of energy which is transmitted to him by one or other of the three circles of petals in his own egoic lotus.
Is that an interesting idea?
Mm-hmm.
So you have three circles of petals, but not everyone can do this, because not all circles of petals are open. What will be the three major keynotes of this kind of invocation? They will correlate with the tiers of petals, so again, it's a simple question. The note of light, the note of love, the note of, well, in a way, yes, but let's be specific as we can, sacrificial will. So there is a formula for consulting our own egoic lotus and getting qualified energy out of our own egoic lotus, as if they were chakras and centers, bring it right down into the personality. But there's a formula. So obviously all he's doing is telling us there is a formula without telling us what it is. But it's very interesting, isn't it, to think that we can have control over these energies, we can call upon them, we can use them, they can appear, they can be put to work, they can be sent back. This is very technical stuff. And it requires as much precision as dealing with a scientific problem that is dangerous. Yeah. All right, the next one, the formula.
The formula for a particular petal in a circle of petals with which he may choose to work. All these concern primarily the will aspect, as far as the thought form to be produced is concerned. For the magician is the will or purpose or spirit behind the objective phenomenon which he is in the process of producing.
Now, we sometimes think that a petal is simply an accumulation of virtue. Of course, virtue means power, which is interesting. But what is DK hinting here that a petal really is? A petal in the egoic lotus. Energy centers, empowered from the triad and from the monad. 9 or 12 energy centers in our egoic lotus from which we can draw down energy to bring about the effects we want as a magician. Now, how do you know that the petals are energy centers empowered from the triad and empowered from the monad? How do we know that? Take a look at the map. Take a close look. Very close. Just 1 second. Oh, I can't. That's no good. I'm going to have to make it smaller. That'll do. Take a look at the setup. You've got 9 petals there, and maybe 12, but let's just deal with 9. What do you see that reveals to you that the petals are energy centers empowered from the triad and the monad? What do you see?
The lines.
The lines. Exactly, the lines. Now, the lines, every knowledge petal is touched by one of 3 green lines. Hence, the triad is behind those knowledge petals. Every love petal is touched by one of 3 blue lines. Every will petal is touched by one of 3 red lines. Okay? That's the triad. Meaning, the power of the triad is behind every petal in the egoic lotus. They are not just accumulations from below. Now, the monad. Every empowering center in the triad is activated by an aspect of the monad. So the monad stands behind the power of the triad. So when we invoke the energy of a petal, we've got this superstructure behind it. The heavenly power is behind the petal. Now, you know, we're doing a little investigating here. I can feel the moon is in Scorpio because we're going into deeper things for which there are no immediate formulas. How would you go about invoking the energy of a petal? What would you do? You don't know the formula yet, but you want to touch what the petal can offer. What would you do?
Meditation.
Yes, you would meditate, and now what would be the content?
You could do the great invocation.
You could do all that, but you're both talking about things that are true but general. Mm-hmm. What specifically could you do?
Specific in your mind about what you really want to invoke.
Yes.
And to find the exact pattern for that.
Yes, that's right. You need to know what each petal actually gives. Mm-hmm. And he tells us. And you need to know the major planet or sign or ray associated with each petal. And knowing what it gives, what its potentials are, and knowing the subtle energies behind it, you can set up a meditation that targets those things and can draw them down much more specifically. Actually, knowing the colors of the petal and using those colors in the imagination, you have a number of links to the quality of the petal. And you can call on it. Now, have you ever felt in your life that you needed something? Uh-huh. Have you ever looked up to your own egoic lotus for that which you might need? Because in a way, it represents the powers of the solar angel, the diversified powers of the solar angel. So, you know, I'm just thinking off the top of my head, but if I needed the will to sacrifice, what could I do? In general, of course, I could invoke the entire sacrifice tier. What kind of sacrifice do I want to invoke?
If you want to sacrifice all forever, you invoke the ninth.
There. I'm going to leave the ninth one to Gisla. I'll take the eighth. Precisely the scope of what you want to invoke determines the petal you will target, and then you start to tune in on it, but don't try to invoke the ninth petal unless you're a third degree initiate or close. And the same for the eighth petal, the second degree is involved there. So it at least has to be unfolding. So the quality of the eighth petal is sacrifice without asking for any return. It's got a Scorpio quality to it. And you could focus on the sacrifice of the desire nature, for instance, by invoking the energy of the eighth petal, because that's just where it happens. What happens at the second initiation? What happens to your astral body? What happens to selfishness? What happens to desire? That's all eighth petal stuff. So what am I getting at here? That heaven has what you need if you know the formulas and the methods of approach through occult meditation. And a whole field of access is opened up if we know these things. This, I think, will point to the scientific magic of the future. Because he says, you know, the formula for any particular petal in a circle of petals with which he may choose to work. You can work with a petal. You can work with a whole tier. You can even work with the jewel and the lotus. You can work with this collection of energy centers that is above your personality. So what I'm trying to do here is expand the vision of what magic can mean. Because magic is all about bringing heaven to earth. So you have to know how to approach heaven in order to bring it to earth. Okay. Next.
The formula which sweeps into activity and thus produces the form, those Agnisurians who are energized by any particular aspect of soul force. Where the two forces are brought into contact, the form is produced, or the third energy center appears or manifests.
Okay, and the third energy center in this case is what? The form itself? Now, he's telling us something about different Agnisurians, and they respond to different aspects of solar force. What does Surya mean?
Sun.
Surya.
Sun.
Sun. These are emotional Buddhic devas which are affected by solar energies. Solar plexus, the solar heart of the sun for Buddhi. So I don't know which particular aspects are which, and maybe it's also your egoic lotus that's involved here. Maybe your egoic lotus is involved. Okay. But you can invoke different Agnisurians for different tasks. Maybe your egoic lotus is involved, and maybe it must be the planet or the sun. Will and desire create a form, but you need the Agnisurians to help create the form because they are desire. You need the Agnisurians to help create the form. No form will appear without sufficient desire. But it's not just I'm going to invoke the Agnisurians, it's very particularized. And we don't dare fool around until we know exactly what we have to bring in. How many aspects are there of solar force? You know, how many aspects? Could be as many as there are planets, because every planet is an aspect of solar force. Okay, how many aspects of solar force? Well, planets are aspects of solar force. Okay. That's another formula. So, a third energy center appears, or the energy of the will aspect, the energy of desire or love, and finally, the consequent thought form, I suppose, working out in the ethers. And then precipitating into dense matter. Okay. Go ahead.
There is no contradiction here to the occult teaching that father and mother, or spirit and matter, when brought into contact, produce the son. The difficulty which students have to surmount consists in the true interpretation the three terms, mother, matter, moisture, in brackets, all the waters.
Okay, let's do our best with this, huh? Let's see. I mean, this is not easy material. Go ahead.
In creation, the three vibratory spheres. One, the dense physical, leading to mother matter. Two, the etheric matter, Holy Spirit. Three, the astral, moisture, water.
Okay, so he has a different definition for matter in this particular sequence. Here it's pretty easy to see that water is astral, Holy Spirit is etheric, and matter is dense. But here the terminology is different, and matter becomes etheric, mother becomes the dense physical, and moisture is water. These three vibratory spheres work as a unit of precipitation during the earlier stages of creation and must not be separated or distinguished apart. So in other words, if you desire something strongly enough, you will collect the vital forces which will make it appear. That's all he's saying. Keen desire mobilizes vitality, which makes something appear physically. Keen desire is moisture or water. Mobilizing vitality is matter or Holy Spirit. The appearance is mother or matter. So, and that's why he says, earlier stages of creation. Later we will have to add other forces.
Sorry, I didn't see the comma there. I believe
it's okay. It's okay.
With you now.
So let's go ahead.
On the path of evolution, if the subject may be approached from a different angle and thus somewhat clarified, distinctions are made, and on the path of evolution, or of return, they are, as we well know, surmounted.
So what's he saying here? He's warning us against splitting things up too much, is he? Because he says it's all like one process. But what is the idea here? Why, on the path of evolution, should distinctions be surmounted? What is it about evolution that contributes to this? You know, because on the path of evolution, split, 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 split. That's how it works. More and more diversity.
Understanding the whole?
Right. Gathering things together into greater wholes. Mm. So that...
On the middle point of equilibrium, as on our globe, for instance, confusion ensues in the mind of the student, owing to the occult fact that the various formulas. But the various formulas are being employed simultaneously. The thought forms are at all stages of construction, and the ensuing chaos is terrible.
This is from the point of view of the master. We're not even sure what it's all about. But I guess what I was trying to say and couldn't quite get out was that on the path of evolution, things are seen as parts of each other, or parts of a whole. And on the path of involution, things are separating out from a whole. Now, we're not one place or another. We're both. Things are splitting up, things are coming together, and we're in the middle, we're on a warring planet whose symbol is the cross. We have an equality of involutionary and evolutionary forces, and this is symbolized by the fact, okay, equality of involutionary and evolutionary forces, symbolized by the fact that the moon, earth, and sun are all seen to be the same size, and especially the sun and the moon. They are so positioned for in the eclipse cycle that they just cover each other exactly. When you have a lunar eclipse, the sun shines upon the earth and covers the moon exactly. When you have a solar eclipse, the moon goes before the face of the sun and covers the sun exactly. Involution is the moon. It is equal to evolution, which is the sun. All of these forces on our planet have a certain equality of strength, and we're caught in the middle on this planet between involution and evolution, just like St. Paul, as a struggling Scorpio, he found himself caught in the middle, and he could only say, I'm a wretched person, and who will save me from this death? So that's where we are now. We're not Venus and we're not Mars. We're in the middle. Okay. Do we get that idea? Much splitting up, much putting back together, and us in the middle, splitting up, putting back together, side by side. And you could say, look at your own mental plane. One part of your mind does what? The other part of your mind does what? The lower part of your mind is ruled by Mars. The higher part of your mind is ruled by, well, in a way, except if, Venus is what I'm driving at, because Mercury then is the intuition. But you're also correct, because Mercury can be called the sun of mind. Mars divides and splits and cuts. Venus fuses things together. The divine connector, even the fifth ray Lord is called that. In your own mental nature, you are splitting things apart, you are putting things together, and you're doing both all the time. And you need to do both, because we have not yet clarified the situation so that analysis is no longer needed. In other words, this. Let's just say, you need Mars for analysis and Venus for synthesis. What happens if you try to put together unanalyzed pieces? In other words, unclarified pieces.
Confusion.
Yeah, ugliness, confusion, chaotic organization. You don't know what you're doing.
Out of control.
So, let's just say, if you're going to make a beautiful ring which has 50 little stones in it, what happens if you put 50 uncut, unpolished, irregular stones any old place? How's the ring going to turn out?
Dull.
Yeah, very bad, ugly, maybe a work of art, but on the other hand, I guess what I look for... Yeah, but you know what I mean? If you have in mind that that's the kind of material you want to work with. But I look for the fifth ray to cut the stones, polish the stones, regularize the stones. That's the lower fifth ray. And I look for Venus and the higher fifth ray to put them exactly in place, exactly in relation, in perfect order. So there's a total united synthetic effect. That's what I mean, according to the taste of the artist, of course. But I'm talking about making a ring for a very conventional queen.
Oh, you're moving the goalpost now!
And I guess I'm trying to say that maybe I should use the analogy of a jigsaw puzzle. If the pieces are not properly shaped, they won't fit together into the whole. So maybe that would be a more fitting analogy. Okay. On the middle point of equilibrium as our globe, the chaos is terrible. Okay.
The rule which we are commenting upon may be interpreted as stating that in the magical world, the energy of the waters becomes paramount, and desire for the form and the fulfillment of its objective increases. This takes place after the will energy has formed the central nucleus by being brought into contact with the desire force. The magician, through desire or strong motive, increases the vitality of the form until it is so powerful and intense in its own separated life that it is ready to go forth on its mission upon the physical plane.
Okay, good. Now take what you just read and relate what is just said to the vital power. Because we learned the dual forces on the plane whereon the vital power must be sought are seen. Rule 7. Now we're in rule... What is it? 7, 8, 9, 10. Relate what was just said here to the idea of the vital power. Obviously, it's clear, isn't it, that the vital power seems to mean a lot of different things. It's going on in the head. It's sought on the astral plane. It is achieved by the master. And yet we're supposed to be able to achieve something like it here. It has a number of different applications. How does what is just said here relate to the vital power? This is a very occult, you know. I don't know what book we are. We in Cosmic Fire here? Or is this white magic? It feels like it. The energy of the waters really gets strong. The desire for form and the fulfillment of its objective increases. So let's just say the emotional content of the form increases in intensity and vitality. This takes place after the will energy has formed the central nucleus by being brought into contact with the desire force. I suppose this is how to create a causal body, you know. He's just told us how to do this. But how does it relate to the man creating a form? It's almost as if through the mind and on the mental plane, the will energy is active, forming a central nucleus which is the center of the form to be built. The magician, through desire or strong motive, increases the vitality. Now that's the vital force. That's a form of the vital force. Can you make this practical in your own life when it comes to your own creative acts in the simplest possible way? Do you want to do this? I really want to do it. As a matter of fact, the more I think about it, the more I want to do it. I want to do it so much that I can't stop thinking about it. I'm going to do it. We've all been through that, right? You know, I just remember, I recently I had to do an unpleasant thing and I couldn't decide whether I should or not. Then I began leaning towards doing it. And the more I leaned, the more I found the desire to do it increase. And increase until I found myself writing a letter that did it. I felt the growing intensity of the desire to see this thing carried out. I should have been studying myself more at the moment. I might have pulled back and not done it. But I felt the astral power grow around the intention.
It's sort of magnetic as well, because it gathers the bits and pieces around you that are necessary.
Yes,
to
yes,
form
yes.
The whole and to get it done.
Yes, that's right. It also has a reflex action on the planning of how to do it, and it's a loop. But let's just say that intensity of desire forces precipitation. And so the vitalization of desire forces precipitation at a certain point of intensity.
So you were not really in control?
Well, it's a good question. At the time, I certainly felt I was. But when I look back on it, I said, why did I move so fast? I deliberated for a long time. And then something swept over me. And I said, I will do this. And as I resolved, and that I will do it, followed this growth of vital emotion that was leaning in the direction of doing it. Then came the decision, I will, and the desire to do so did not go away, it continued strong, and to it was added the effective will, which carried out the intention. So I definitely kept my intention and I was in control, but I don't know why the emotion got so strong, which...
Was it also to get it off your back?
Uh-huh. Because that's a legitimate question. To me, it seemed more like something that had to be done. I didn't want to say, you know, it wasn't that I had a very uncomfortable feeling because I wasn't doing anything. And I just said, I got to get rid of this. It wasn't only that. There was the conviction that something had to be done.
Perhaps it was the truth within that made you realize that it had to be done.
It just got very intense, that's all I can say. And I felt it reached the point of precipitation. That's why I related to this particular study, because it ties in exactly with a sufficiency of motive power to make something happen, and the growth of the motive power increases the vitality of the form until it is so powerful and intense that it's ready to go forth.
And how was the feeling after you had done it?
Hey, the moon is in Scorpio. At first, good. And then second thoughts.
Second thought?
second thoughts, and then analysis, and then evaluation, and then recommitment to the path taken. That's how it worked for me. Because one can never... Well, it's psychological, you know. Any second-rate type doesn't like to cause fragmentation of some kind. So the bias of the second ray is to try to hold things together. But if you are a surgeon and you encounter a healthy system in part, but cancer is appearing, you can't try to hold it together. You have to separate the area of disease from the area of health. And that's what I think it was all about. Even though my bias is to hold things together. Well, okay. Let's see where we are here. Just a little more and we'll finish the cosmic fire part.
The building devas who have been impelled to construct the form out of the myriads of elemental lives available have completed their work and now cease from constructing.
Okay, so let the lesser builders cease their work and the greater, whatever it is, devas enter on their cycle. Okay, so construction is over.
This particular type of energy no longer drives.
Drives the lesser lives.
Drives the lesser lives in any specific direction, and the final cycle of work upon the astral plane is entered upon. This is summed up in
the next rule. Okay. You know, I don't know why DK expanded. He expanded Rule 10 beyond belief. 150 or 60 pages. We could take the whole 5-day session and not finish Rule 10. But the words are to this effect. Let the outer builders cease their labors then. So those are the builders that are constructing this particular type, the construction of the form. And inner workers now have to enter in on their cycle, and he has not told us what they are. But in the next white magic part, he does tell us what these inner workers are. So we hope to reach that after our break.